Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, some of our favorite recent conversations to listen to on this unofficial start to the summer season. Introverts, listen up, because later in the show we'll hear some helpful advice for you in the romantic realm. We'll also hear today from some of the heroes of the hospital, nurses, who tell us about some of their struggles and triumphs.
I was bullied by my fellow nurses, bullied by doctors, belittled by patients. But at the same time, every time I walked out of the hospital, I felt stronger as a registered nurse.
Stay tuned for my whole conversation with the journalist Alexandra Robbins, who wrote a book called The Nurses, A Year of Secrets, Drama, and Miracles with the Heroes of the Hospital. And we'll hear calls from millennials on generational differences in morality, a response to our first guest today, David Brooks. He wrote a column earlier this spring called The Moral Bucket List that struck a real chord with people. It lingered on the Times most emailed list for days. The column was adapted from his heartfelt new book, The Road to Character, where he explores the deeper values that should inform our lives, especially in our relationships to other people, in this age of what David calls the big me. David Brooks, welcome back to WNYC, and congratulations on the new book and creating some real meaning for people with this.
Thank you, Brian. It's actually always a great pleasure to be back with you.
Thank you very much. Would you start personally the way you start the column about people you wish you were more like and why?
Yeah, well, about once a month I run into somebody who's just remarkable. They radiate an inner light. I didn't put it in the column, but one occasion happened. It was like about a year ago. I was up in Frederick, Maryland, and I met some women who teach immigrants how to read. And this process, teaching them English and then how to read English, can take years and years. And so I just happened to be in a room with about 30 of them. And as soon as you walk in, you feel something. You feel just this goodness. And it's not a bragging goodness. It's just a quiet, patient goodness. And they just seem joyful in their demeanor. And they make you feel valued and important. And they're not, telling what great work they're doing. They're not thinking of themselves at all. And I remember thinking, I've achieved more career success than I ever thought I would, but I don't have that. I don't have that kind of inner light. And I'd like to get that as my only life. I'd like to try to move toward that. And so the book is really an attempt to find people who've achieved that, not only some outward success, which is good, but also that sort of inner tranquility and joy and virtue. And I just was inarticulate about that.
And so before we go down the bucket list a little bit of virtues and people who exemplify them, you wrote that to become more like those people, you have to work harder to save your own soul, to have the kind of moral adventures, you use that term, that produce that kind of goodness. And the word adventures sounds like you can set up some kinds of experiences to move yourself in that direction. Can you? Have you?
Well, I think the core of it is a basic humility. And humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. It's thinking accurately about yourself. My favorite definition, it's not mine, but it's radical self-awareness from a position of other-centeredness. So seeing yourself from a distance and realizing how the moments when you're great and the moments and those sins you have. And then at the end of the day, I have a friend at the end of each day, he sits back and think, he's identified his core sins, how it leads to behaviors he's not proud of. In his case, it's a hard-heartedness. People will tell him personal problems, and he's thinking about his next appointment, or he's just not present for them fully. And he tries to think of how he did better. So some things you can't organize, like suffering or falling in love or losing a job or finding a job. But some things you can be more mindful about, identifying your core sin, writing it down, journaling about it, arranging discussion groups, how do you make use of suffering, how do you find a vocation. I think those things we can be pretty purposeful about, and just realizing, life is a moral adventure, and you're building yourself or weakening yourself depending on the decisions you make.
And that is the first item on the bucket list. The moral bucket list is what you call the humility shift. And in the book, you call it the crooked timber tradition, which emphasizes your own brokenness. Why use that word brokenness?
Well, you know, I think that is the big shift. I do think, you know, there have been always two traditions running through Western civilization, a realistic tradition, which believes that we're both splendidly endowed and fundamentally broken. And that it comes from the Bible, but also the crooked timber phrase is from Immanuel Kant. He said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was made. And that emphasizes our weakness. And then there's another more romantic tradition, which we associate with Rousseau and others, who says that deep down we're really good inside. And I think our society is now in the romantic tradition. That's the way we raise our kids. We tell them how wonderful they are, follow your passion, be true to yourself, do what feels right. What feels right is what's moral. But I think we have to rediscover the old realistic tradition, which Augustine spoke to, which Kant spoke to, which George Eliot, the great novelist, spoke to. And that is we're deeply broken inside. We're fundamentally screwed up. We're self-centered. We're selfish. We see the world, as David Foster Wallace put it in his great Kenyon commencement address, everything's either in front of us, behind us, beside us. Everything revolves around us in the way we see the world. And so when you become aware of that, then you realize the many flaws you have and how hard you have to work to overcome them.
And in the book, I see most of the chapters are moral essays with a biographical narrative. You mentioned some of them just now, but Dwight Eisenhower is your example of learning the lesson of self-defeat. Why a general who won a world war and two presidential elections as an example of self-defeat?
Because he was not that impressive as a young man. All the characters were messes early in life and built themselves into something impressive. His problem was his temper, and the story I tell in the book is when he was 9, he wanted to go trick-or-treating, and his mom, who was this remarkable woman named Ida Eisenhower, wouldn't let him. And he threw a temper tantrum, and he punched the tree in his front yard so bad he rubbed all the skin off his fingers. And Ida sent him to his room, had him cry for an hour, and then went up and bound his wounds. And she recited to him a verse, which was, "He that conquereth his own soul is greater than he who taketh a city." And when Eisenhower wrote his memoirs many decades later, he said that was the most important conversation of his life because it taught him that he had this problem, his temper. And he had to fight it. And it took him really decades, all his life. You know, we think of him as this garrulous country club kind of guy. But, you know, at night in World War II and as president, he's up night, insomnia, drinking, throat infections, blood pressure spikes, filled with anxiety and hatred. But he knew he couldn't lead effectively that way. He had to conquer hatred. And some of the things he did was quite stupid, quite shallow. He would, if he hated a person, he'd write their name on a piece of paper and rip it up and throw it in the garbage can.
Huh. And some of it was, I guess that's better than punching him in the nose.
Yeah, so, you know, he turned himself from a really angry, tempestuous kind of guy into a calm and optimistic guy and made himself strong in his weakest spot. And so that's why I chose him as the model of self-defeat.
All right, let's take another one. Francis Perkins, you tell the story of how the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City in 1911 transformed what was already a career dedicated to workers' rights into something even more profound. What happened to Frances Perkins?
Yeah, she was having tea in one of those buildings, homes on the north side of Washington Square in Lower Manhattan, and they hear a commotion, they rush out, and they stumble across one of the most famous fires in American history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, and they think they see what are people throwing bundles of clothing out of the top floor windows. But in fact, it was not like 9/11, where people had decided to leap to their deaths rather than be burned to death. And she sees 50-odd people go over the edge this way, and I call it her call within a call. And what I mean by that, I've borrowed the phrase, but I think what the phrase suggests to me is that you have a career and you do it on for a number of reasons, for status, security, just because it feels good. But then something happens and you self-quiet. You become an instrument in a cause. And she spent the rest of her life pursuing, in a much more hardened way than she ever had before, compromises that would advance the cause of worker rights. She would work with anybody. She lost her gentility. She was just really tough. And she fought the cause of worker rights. My favorite story, later in life, she's lobbying up in Albany for a piece of legislation, and she realizes that no one will take her seriously because it's, you know, 1920 or whatever, and she's a young woman. And she keeps a file folder at home called Notes on the Male Mind. Hmm. And she writes that they won't take me seriously as a young woman, but they all want to be loved by their mothers. And so she starts dressing like a mom and gets the nickname Mama Perkins. And so turns herself into an instrument for the cause and becomes an amazing lobbyist. And then the first woman in a cabinet, FDR names her Secretary of Labor.
Gee, maybe somebody could run for president as a grandmother.
Someone's trying it. Good point.
We'll get to that later. Perkins is such an interesting example, the story, the way you tell it. And it relates back to something that struck me at the beginning of your column, that people grade themselves on a forgiving curve, that as long as we're not obviously hurting anyone and people seem to like you, you must be doing okay, which I think raises a very challenging question of how much do you have to go out of your way in order to live a moral life? Have you come to an answer to that question for yourself or in general?
I lean on the arduous side. One of the chapters contrasts Samuel Johnson, the great British essayist, with Montaigne, the great French essayist. And they're two different approaches. They both wrote about themselves, and they both wrote very morally about themselves, and more or less keeping journals or essays to try to investigate their weaknesses. Johnson would write about his tendency toward envy or toward sloth. And he was very critical of himself. Montaigne was like, I accept myself. I'm fine with myself. I don't know how to die. Nature will teach me how to die. One of my students compared them to East Coast and West Coast rappers, that Johnson was very arduous and stern, strenuous, a lot of suffering. Montaigne was like, you know, I'm weak. I have my thoughts jump around. I'm not very impressive. But, you know, I have to learn to accept myself. And I can see both categories. I think Johnson imposed a lot of unnecessary suffering on himself. But ultimately for me, maybe because I'm an East Coast guy, I think he built himself into a really great, great man. And he really was a mess as a young man. He was suffering from all these illnesses, Tourette's, OCD, had failed as a teacher, had failed as a student. And by the end, he's just this large, capacious figure who not only is great in the world, but is helping people at home, collecting people who have nowhere else to live and housing with them. And so his transformation, to me, is the more inspiring. But it does involve a fair bit of self-criticism.
I get. I'll tell you a story along these lines. One time before I interviewed a very famous progressive activist, whose identity I'll actually protect here because this was a personal story that he and his wife told me off the air, they were dismayed that their adult daughter had taken the message of global inequality so personally and so far that she went to live in poverty with people in a village in a developing country, because she couldn't reconcile trying to change the world while living a middle-class American existence. And I guess that's at the extreme end of the spectrum you're thinking about, that was 10 years ago. But I've never forgotten that moment because it challenges us, you know, in a pretty profound way to think how far do we have to go to dismiss the comforts, the trappings, in order to leave a personally moral or what she considered a politically moral life.
Yeah. Well, two of the contrasts I have in the book is between Frances Perkins, who I've mentioned, who became Secretary of Labor. And she was involved in politics and involved a lot of compromise, working with people she didn't particularly like. And then the other character is Dorothy Day, who decided she needed to live a life of poverty in Lower Manhattan. And she not only lived in the soup kitchens, or not only worked in the soup kitchens, she lived there for decade after decade. And she could not leave the sort of political life where you're compromising, doing morally hazardous things. She not only had to do good, she had to be pure inside. And so she just said no to politics and said yes to activism and service. And she was the more religious of the figures, but she embraced poverty for exactly that reason. And again, I don't think there's one correct answer to be worldly or to be otherworldly. But they're both tough routes to leading a virtuous life.
We're talking to David Brooks here on WNYC on The Brian Lehrer Show, the New York Times columnist, whose column, The Moral Bucket List, from 9 days ago, is still at number 4 on the most email list on the Times, which is pretty darn unusual. And it's an adaptation or adapted from his new book, which is called The Road to Character. Our lines are full, so as we finish up with some of you, some others of you might get in here to talk about The Road to Character, and then we'll get into some current politics and policy. Jim in Sayreville, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I want to thank you, David, for speaking the truth, and I especially appreciated your wonderful column last Friday in the Times about the narcissism in our society. I believe it's the worship of the self that kills the soul, and that's why the ancient message in the Greek myth of Narcissus is that narcissism leads to death, because the character Narcissus, who was in love with himself, drowned himself to death by kissing his own image in the pond of water. So I think that's where our society is today. I believe we have a society of me-itis, where the community is broken down, social bonding is broken down, social connectedness is broken down. It's all about me, as you say in your column last Friday, the big me, and I think that's what we have to address.
Jim, could I ask you a follow-up question? Would you consider your own politics generally more liberal or generally more conservative?
I'm a left-wing progressive Democrat, and I support poor people in the middle class against the richest 1%.
And do you think this big me critique strikes you at where you live politically as well as personally or beyond politically?
Yes, I'm a Democratic committeeman, and I try to live my politics day every day of my life.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. So, David, I'm setting you up there to talk about how this applies to left and right, and anything else you want to say to Jim.
Yeah, well, first, thank you for the kind words. You know, I think this is beneath politics. A lot of the, you know, one of the couplets that Samuel Johnson, who I just mentioned, is famous for, I'm going to butcher it a little, but it's something like, of all the things that human hearts endure, how few are those that kings can cause and cure. And many of the things that matter most to our life are our relationships or faith or how we serve our communities. And they're beneath left and right, beneath politics. But I do think we have a culture that's become more narcissistic. And I'd say there's conservative and liberal things contributing to that, or things associated with conservatives. The market has become a big self-promotion machine, you know, to succeed in the market. And market values have in some places triumphed over everything else. On the left side, I think some of the individualism of some of the social values have undercut community. And I do think, you know, the statistic I cite all the time is that in 1950, Gallup asked our high school students, are you a very important person? And 12% said yes. They asked the same question in 2005, and this time it wasn't 12% who thought they were really important. It was 80%. Hmm. And so we've raised our kids in a way to tell them how great they are. And frankly, a lot of us were raised that way, and so we believed them. And so we've become, I think there's ample evidence, a more narcissistic society. And believe me, we're better. We should never want to go back. We're a less racist, less anti-Semitic culture. But in this one sphere of humility, I do think we have something to learn from the people who raised us and the people who are grandfather's parents' generation. And it has negative effects. I think it hurts community. It hurts a sense of civic unity. It hurts moral conversation. It even leads to polarization. If you realize that you only have a piece of the truth and the people who disagree with you have another piece, then you're going to want to listen to them. But if you're not modest, if you think you have the truth by the short hairs, then the people who disagree with you are just in the way. And so I think egotism is tied to polarization as well.
And yet, one of America's great strengths historically is our individualism. The fact that we're, you know, to oversimplify it, a country born of immigrants who are the risk takers who come and forge their own way, and maybe conservatives more than liberals hold that up as a, you know, an external value, wear that one more on their sleeves these days. But individualism is one of the strengths of American history and the American character. How do you weave that into this narrative of it going too far?
Yeah, well, I'm a dualist. I believe, you know, somebody said there are two sorts of people in the world, those who divide the world into two sorts of people and those who don't. And so I think everything is dual. And so we're both an individual culture, but we're also a very communal culture. Tocqueville celebrated our community. One of my favorite movies, by the way, is a great movie called My Darling Clementine, which is a John Ford Western starring Henry Ford. And it's about how the West was actually settled, not the romantic myth of the John Wayne movies of the lone individual. People came and they build restaurants, they build churches, they build dance halls, they helped each other, and they formed communities, and then sometimes they moved on to another community. So I do think we've, both in left and right, have gotten too far on the side of the individual, and we've weakened community bonds, and certainly Robert Putnam and other sociologists have mentioned that. And the moral language is part of that. The big turn for me is when we lose the word sin. And now sin has a word that means depraved and it seems self-righteous and priggish to a lot of us. But the nice thing about sin is it's communal. We all sin. We all have the same sins. And we all battle our sins together. And when you're working on your own inner life, my belief is you can't do it on your own. We all need redemptive assistance from outside. So character is not this little iron figure inside you. I think it's your ability to make strong connections to ideas, to community groups, to causes, and to tasks that can't be completed in a lifetime. And that was really one of the things I've discovered while writing the book, that I had this Victorian view of character, that it's about this, you know, iron little soldier inside. But then I realized it's about character's outside. It's how strong are your commitments to things.
Richard in Hollis, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Richard.
Hi. It's a pleasure to speak to both of you. I think you're both very much in sync in character and outlook. And I have a quote from Montaigne, who David Brooks spoke about before. It's a lesser-known quote, but it's very much in line with what you've been discussing. Let me read it to you. To storm a beach, conduct the embassy, govern a people, these are brilliant actions. To scold, laugh, and deal gently and justly with one's family and oneself, that is something rarer, more difficult, and less noticed in the world.
Thank you, Richard. And we're both in trouble if he's praising us and comparing us to each other. But is that the Montaigne that you were writing about?
Yeah. No. He retired from public life, and just he thought his goal was to identify himself and really understand himself. And some people think he really was a pioneer in self-discovery. He just sat down and said, "I'm just going to observe myself." And he did it so modestly, you know. He didn't have a lot of charisma, so if he didn't have charisma, he would tell you. If he didn't have a great skills in chess or a great memory, he would tell you. He just said, "I want to understand myself." And as he did that, I think he got more delightful and more small, I guess, in a way. And I find him a completely entrancing character.
You know, another one from the book that's intriguing to me is because it seems different than the others. You mentioned the writer George Eliot as an example of building character through a second love, a relationship later in life. Why George Eliot, and why that particular circumstance as part of the road to character?
Well, you know, I think she was, like the other characters in the book, was rather unimpressive as a young woman. She was very emotionally needy and was falling for all sorts of guys. And then she found one man, George Lewes, who really was her match. And it took courage. George Lewes was legally married to a woman, but the marriage was estranged, and the woman had children with another man. And so she was going to be called an adulterer if she went with Lewes. And she had to make the choice, do I choose him and risk social ostracism, or do I not choose him? And she chose him, and it worked out for her. They had a very successful marriage and a deep love for one another, and it made her, I think he helped make her and supported her as she became the great novelist. And the phrase second love is a phrase I got from Roger Scruton, a British philosopher. And I like it because we all know the first love, which is the romantic, idealistic love that Taylor Swift sings about. But the second love is a harder love. It's when you're older and you've maybe had some scars and you're enveloped in commitments. And it's the sort of long-lasting love that you see some people are fortunate enough to build in adulthood. And it's realistic, it's particular, it's local, and it's filled with commitments. And so she was able to enjoy that, and she's sort of a standard and inspiration for that.
Doris in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Doris.
Yes, hi. I'm so happy to speak to you, David Brooks. I read you assiduously and think it's great stuff you write about. But how would you suggest one deals with the despair and disillusionment at the world today that one feels? How do you deal with it?
I'll jump in here and say, talk to the next 10, 20-year-olds you see walking down the street. But, David, I don't know if you would go there or not.
No, I would totally agree. I teach college, and I spend a lot of time around my students, and they are super inspiring. You know, I'm not a real big believer that we go through periods of cultural rise or cultural decline. I think each era has its own problems. And we're so much better than earlier eras, as I said, in treating people fairly. I think we're more accepting of different races, different genders, different sexual orientations. It's not perfect, but we're better, and I wouldn't want to go back to the past. But we have our own problems, and I do think self-promotion and narcissism are one of our problems, and I don't excuse myself from that. I'm as I said in that column, I'm paid sort of to be a blowhard. I'm paid to volley my opinions and try to seem smarter than I really am. And so, but that is a problem endemic to our culture, which is this over-lavish praise of ourselves and overestimation of our own inner nature. But I don't think we're in a period of decline at all. I think in many ways, you look at all the social indicators, divorce rates are going down, teenage pregnancy is down, abortion rates are down, teenage suicide is down. Young people especially are an incredibly inspiring generation. I think they're all going to have the biggest midlife crisis in human history in about 10 years.
But, why is that?
Because they work so hard and they put so much pressure on themselves. But if I could just say one thing about that, since I do teach, and I basically taught a course that was this book, My students came in so wonderful, so community-oriented, but what they didn't have was a moral vocabulary. They didn't have a set of words to describe their own inner struggles to be good. And one of them said to me over coffee, you know, we're so hungry, we want to be good, but they haven't been given that vocabulary. And I think one of the things we could do for young people and for all of us is to lay out the alternatives of moral ecologies. There are all these traditions handed down to us, whether it's the Greek tradition of, built around glory and honor, the Jewish tradition about obedience to law, the Christian tradition about grace and redemption, the scientific tradition about rational thought. There are all these different moral traditions. I don't think it's a wise idea to try to come up with your own values. Find the wise gifts that have been left to us and follow one of those.
And or multiples of those, right? You can draw from different traditions.
Right. And so with my students, I just said, here's Augustine, here's Moses, here's Descartes. Pick one and mix and match.
Yeah. And I think I've noticed, I mean, you're writing about individual virtue here as it relates to people's relationship to community. But I think I've also noticed over the years that you do this with respect to cultures, too. My impression is you say cultures are more than simply reactions to the physical conditions they have to confront. They then develop traditions or habits that can be more useful or less useful to themselves and to others. And I don't have a specific example off the top of my head, but does that sound like you to you?
Yes. No, I'm a big cultural determinist. I think we're born into a culture, and it sets invisible norms and assumptions in the way we see the world. And when you go abroad, you certainly feel that. And some of the cultural distinctions, or even the way we perceive the world, how our eyes move, there have been all these studies that show certain Asian cultures look at the world and our eyes move in different ways than American eyes as we see the world, and just the values we bring to the world. I'm a big believer that culture determines our thoughts and actions way more than technology, more than economics, more than anything else.
Let's take another call. Bob in Morristown, you're on WNYC with David Brooks.
Yes, Brian. Good morning. Mr. Brooks, I remember several years ago, Brian had Bill Bennett on, who was lecturing us about generally the same topic. And I'd really like to know what qualifies you to lecture us on morality, particularly with your defense of the Freedom of Religion Act in Indiana and your adherence to the idea that belief in something unprovable, as in religion, is a positive thing.
I will just jump in for just a moment and note that among our callers, as among people in general, if they tend to agree with somebody, they laud their willingness to speak out. And if they tend to disagree with somebody, they ask, what makes you qualified to tell us what's right and wrong? But David Brooks, what does make you qualified to tell us what's right and wrong?
I think it's a totally fair question. I certainly would not put myself as an exemplar of any sort of moral example. And in the book, I try to make clear that I'm not doing this because I've learned so much. I'm doing this because I feel the need so much. And, you know, I discovered in my life that I achieved some career success but had not found fulfillment. I found that I had not achieved the inner light that I described earlier in the program that other people have achieved. And so this is really not a book about me reporting on what I have learned and what I have done. It's a book reporting on what other people have learned and what they have done, which I'm trying to learn from. And so it's a journey, and hopefully we're all on a journey to try to get a little better. And I, having finished the book, I can tell you writing a book doesn't make you a wonderful person, and reading this book won't do it. You have to live it out. But I hope what the book does is it gives people a roadmap or a set of friends or inspiration that they can follow or maybe spark some ideas just to pay attention to this. And if we had to be good and moral to write about these issues, then nobody would do it because so few of us capable of achieving that. And yet I think it is important to try to talk about and try to think, well, how can I get a little better today? I just want to say one thing of my defense of the Freedom of Religion Act, the Indiana law. That was an attempt.
Sorry, I was just going to ask you, did you really defend that?
No. I mean, I've written a column. I've meant many columns over the years. I've always been pro-gay marriage. I'm militantly pro-gay marriage. And I've been that more or less out of the womb. And yet, there were two things about that. One, I do think sometimes there's a tension between equality and freedom, which we believe in, and religious liberty. I think somehow we have to respect religion and other people's religions. That doesn't mean they're allowed to discriminate or anything like that. Secondly, just as a matter of pragmatics, I was trying to make the case that the cause of gay rights and gay marriage is moving so fast that the way to move it forward is to let people work it out for themselves and let the current momentum we're enjoying continue, and to turn it into a big culture war so that a lot of people in rural Indiana and places like that suddenly decide the cause of gay rights is an attack on religion. That would I think that would set back the progress toward gay marriage everywhere and gay rights everywhere. I think it would make it a more polarized issue. And for a young man or a young woman trying to come out in rural Indiana, if he was surrounded in a culture war, it would be harder for him or her to do that. And so I was just trying to think pragmatically how to keep the momentum we've enjoyed.
And we'll turn more and more explicitly to politics when we continue with David Brooks in a minute, his new book called The Road to Character. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with New York Times columnist David Brooks. His very widely shared column, which we'll get back to, called The Moral Bucket List, and the new book from which it's adapted called The Road to Character. But David, let's talk about the news a little bit. I just pulled one soundbite for this segment. And if former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley is a name that people don't know yet, they're going to know him at least for his 15 seconds of fame, telling us he's thinking of getting into the Democratic presidential race.
I think what would be more awkward is if no one were willing to compete for the Democratic Party's nomination for president. That would be an extreme poverty indeed.
O'Malley talking to NPR, and he almost makes it sound like he'd be running as a service to Hillary Clinton's ultimate general election campaign. What do you make of O'Malley, and why will he probably run?
Well, you know, it is a service, first of all. I mean, right now Hillary Clinton is in the position of being a monopolist. She's got the field to herself. And, of course, you'd like that if you're a candidate. But we've all covered these campaigns for so long, and the candidates get so much better over the course of the campaign. They get better because somebody's criticizing them and they're responding and they get sharper. I've noticed Jeb Bush on the Republican side is not sharp right now just because he hasn't run in so long. And so I do think he'll help her. What's interesting to me about O'Malley is I'm looking at the NPR cover one webpage today, and he says the headline is America's Economy Needs Sensible Rebalancing, Not Pitchforks. And if he's going to run at her from the right or from the center, I don't think that's where the room is. The party, there are a lot more progressives on to her left than there are moderates to her right in the party right now.
Well, he did sound yesterday when I saw him on Face the Nation to be setting up to run to her left. He kept talking about wages and, you know, things that sound like economic populism.
Yeah. So, well, if he does that, then I think that's the natural running room. I'm not sure his record is such, but he's a attractive candidate. He was a moderately successful governor in Maryland. He didn't leave his successor in too great a shape. But I think, you know, there should be a race in the first place, just because who knows what could happen over the next weeks or months. There should be somebody else in the field. But I think it will make Hillary Clinton better. I think the odds against O'Malley winning are long, but it'll certainly make her better, at least have to debate somebody sensible and somebody real.
Here's one thing that could happen to her. Did you see the Times article today with an advanced look at this book about the money the Clintons got from foreign sources, mostly for the Clinton Foundation, I guess, but implying favors when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State? Do you think there's any potential quid pro quo scandal here, or is this more of the usual anti-Clinton blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, well, so far, the short answer is I don't know. I saw the headline, but I didn't get a chance to read the piece this morning. But we'll see. If there's a quid pro quo, it could damage her. The emails damaged her. They didn't really knock her down. In my view, scandals, unless they're really big scandals, don't hurt candidates unless they stop them. They just march right through them. And so I think that may happen to her. But we'll see. There certainly is a lot of discomfort with the way they raised so much money from so many foreign governments. Was it really just random gifts, or was there – I doubt there's an explicit quid pro quo, but was there the sort of nudged and acknowledged quid pro quos, which are frankly the norm of fundraising these days.
Yeah, the norm of fundraising. And the line seems to be moving in New York State. I don't know if you've been following U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara and some of the indictments that he's been making of New York politicians lately. But that line between quid pro quo and normal campaign contributions or related payments, people are calling that into question right now. So if there's something that looks like money was donated to the Clinton Foundation and then, and came from a particular foreign source, and then the State Department did something policy-wise or even worse, contractually, who knows how that might land with the public psyche? Very differently, I think, than just using a private email account, probably for convenience when, you know, there's no indication of anything specific she was trying to hide.
Right. And this is why I talk about moral ecologies. There are certain things that would have been unthinkable, raising money in a certain way, talking to people in a certain way. And then suddenly that becomes thinkable, and then your standard slips, and there's a slow decay. And so suddenly you're back to talking in explicit quid pro quo terms. And it doesn't seem that wrong because you've gradually got there. The people who wind up doing things, whether it's killing someone, they don't just suddenly – they're not just good, and then suddenly they do something horrific. There's a slow decline in standards, as Bill James, the writer, said. They walk through a series of doors. And in our political culture, we're walking through a series of doors in that direction.
Yeah. Are you looking at today's presidential hopefuls or other politicians through the roads to character that you explore in your book? Or are we looking for different enough skills in our political leaders than those?
No, I do think the presidency is a character-revealing and a character-challenging position. In the first place, you're loved. You're surrounded by love all day and all night. Your political staff just adores you, and they don't want to say anything negative to you. You're like the pretty girl or the handsome guy at the high school who everybody wants to bid their favors for. And so it's very hard to stay modest and humble. And yet I see presidencies rise and fall on the basis of the character traits of the politicians and their strengths and weaknesses. I mean, the obvious case is Watergate. And my point there is that I think it's very hard to be successful long term if inside you're fundamentally screwed up. And Nixon was fundamentally screwed up, and he had success. He won the presidency. But eventually your Watergate comes. And then others, I think President Obama, I think he's a man of integrity. We've had very few scandals in this administration. I do think his combination of extreme self-confidence and combativeness sometimes makes him not as willing to reach out to people and really want to bond with people as maybe we'd like in a president. President Bush had a mixture of intellectual insecurity, and which he compensated for with aggressiveness. I think each president has traits that a novelist could describe and which shape their presidency. So we should pay attention to them as they campaign.
You don't think someone could be a selfish SOB in his personal life, but know what policy levers to pull to create jobs and avoid wars, and we look too much at the personalities?
Yeah, I don't think so. You could make a case about LBJ. It would be an interesting case. But I think eventually if you can't hear people, if you can't be present for people, if you don't have some sense that I'd rather sacrifice my political career for this piece of integrity, I think it's hard to be successful over the long term. I think you can do it in the short term. And maybe you can do it in certain industries. I do think character is destiny. I basically do believe in that maxim.
Kathy in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your recent columns that have to do with the subject of your new book have been mentioned as suggested readings in the room of AA, of Alcoholics Anonymous, quite often lately. And much of what you write about are the tenets of the program, getting rid of selfishness and self-centeredness. And I wondered if you knew about that comparison.
I didn't know. I'm honored that they would mention it in those contexts. I did know about the comparison I've learned from AA. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I wrote a column about AA, and it precisely for that reason, I found the methods that are embraced there. First, the self-emptying, the admission of weakness, and then the acknowledgement that you can't do it on your own. You need redemptive assistance from outside. I do think whether it's grown out of a religious background or a non-religious background, AA is a very diverse organization. That basic model of going down into the valley of humility and then rising up with arm's length with somebody else is the basic U-shaped life course that many of the characters in the book took. They had some fall, they had a period of self-discovery, and then they had a period where they wanted to turn their fall into something good. And so that was part of their moral growth. And there's sort of a U-shape to that.
Robin in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Nice to speak with you, David. I've been a long-time admirer of your columns. I recently took my son to the Dominican Republic to volunteer, and I felt like I had to take him out of his normal environment to really reach him with the community service, just because I find society a little bit cynical. And the most profound part of the volunteering was actually really meeting people who were very, very impoverished, and walking through favelas and shaking hands and going into homes. And I feel like part of what you've been saying, which is there's a disconnect, and we need more community. We need to come together more to build character.
Yeah, I would say I took my kids to the Dominican Republic as well about 10 years ago, a couple times, and my kids had never seen poverty on that level before. So that by itself was an important revelation, and since we've been seeing it elsewhere in Africa and so on. But that is itself an important thing for, I think, people to see just how other people live, and then to get to know people in that context and see, you know, they have the normal range of human virtues and vices, of joy and family and struggle. And so I think that by itself, my somewhat concern with some of the community service that's done in the country is that it can become a patch. And what I mean by that is this. I was at a very fancy prep school, and I asked the person running the school if the school taught character. And the headmaster mentioned that, well, we do a lot of community service. And I was asking about something internal, and she answered with something external. And so I mean, it's so important to do community service, but I'd hate to think that's just the way we talk about character, because doing good for the world is important, but internal growth is something a little different. And, of course, they can contribute to each other, but having a language for internal growth is different. Somebody gave me a great example the other day, which was that instead of telling a kid this was language, and I've forgotten which researcher came up with this, instead of telling your son or daughter, you know, I'm so glad you did your homework before going in the yard, you can say, I'm so glad you did your homework first. That shows you're a responsible person. And that second sentence highlights one fact, that the decisions we make form the character we have. And so it transfers the thinking a little into what sort of person am I building? And that's sort of making it a moral occasion out of a regular everyday circumstance.
Kay in Astoria, you're on WNYC with David Brooks. Hi, Kay.
Yeah, hi. I think David Brooks has the luxury to make these statements because he's never been a mother and he's never been a woman. He stands there and talks about humility and how self-centered we are. However, mothers devote their entire lives to other people. I do that, then I go to a job where I know I get paid less than my male coworkers, and then I come home to another full job, which is taking care of my children. And I have somebody like David Brooks telling me that I'm not humble enough and I'm too self-centered to make this world a better place. I find it extremely offensive. And it's not only the decisions we make about our character that shape our lives, but it's experiences. And obviously, David Brooks has had a very, very different set of experiences than I have.
Well, I guess I'd say I'm not calling you self-centered, and I'm not saying you're egotistical. I don't know you. I wouldn't certainly make a judgment. I do think we're in a culture that I think does encourage these things, and I hope I've made it clear that I think I'm example A of what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to excuse myself from this, and I'm not trying to judge other people. I wrote the book because I felt I needed to try to find ways to get better, and I found examples of people who demonstrate that way. And some of the way they demonstrate, some of the paths they demonstrated are, frankly, through motherhood. One of the characters in the book is a woman named Dorothy Day, and she led a life of some disorder and some disorganization. And then she gave birth to her daughter, and she wrote a beautiful passage, a beautiful essay for a magazine called The New Masses about that. And one of the sentences she had in there was that if I had sculpted the greatest sculpture, painted the greatest painting, or written the greatest symphony, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. And with that came the need to worship and adore. And so it was the act of motherhood that gave her, aroused a sense of love, decentered the self, gave her a sense of humility because the love was so powerful, and it moved her to want to love more and to want to love other things. Her love moved her outward, and she spent the rest of her life serving in many different ways, not only serving her daughter, but she founded a progressive newspaper called The Catholic Worker. She founded soup kitchens, homeless shelters, and she spent the rest of her life living in those kitchens. And it was, but it was that act of giving birth that sort of focused her life and gave it a life that was really conditioned and shaped by love. And it turned into a religious love. She became a Catholic, a progressive Catholic thinker and worker and writer. And so, you know, I think the act of parenthood, and I think fathers and mothers equally, can have this transformational effect on people. And that's sort of things we aspire to.
But do you think there is a check your privilege moment here at all? Like, does the book take a stance that's sort of from the lens of somebody who's maybe more economically comfortable and, you know, then inspect ourselves through that lens, but doesn't deal with the kind of, you know, lower socioeconomic realities, people who maybe are struggling, maybe they're single parents, maybe they're, you know, working so hard at two jobs and then to come home and take care of the kids, that it's kind of a luxury to have the kind of introspection in the way you're describing it in the book?
Yeah, I really do reject that. I come across that argument a bit. And, you know, I would just observe, go to a church, go to a synagogue, go to a poor area. Those people care about their moral lives. The pews and the churches and synagogue and the mosques are filled with people without much material abundance, but who are earnestly concerned about their moral lives, earnestly concerned about being good. If they're faithful, earnestly concerned about living according to what they think is God's law and God's wishes. And so they do suffer more economic deprivation than I do, for sure. But I do not think this is correlated on the income scale. I think rich people can feel hollow inside. I think poor people can. I think middle-class people can. And all those people can also feel enriched inside, and all those people can equally strive to try to live better lives. And so I don't think this is that the desire to have a moral education, if we can put it that way, is something that's a luxury. I think it's something all people feel. We're born with moral imagination and moral aspirations, a desire just to be good and to feel a little hollow when we're not. And when I had no money, I felt that. When I have a little more money, frankly, I feel it more. And so I don't think this correlated that well to income.
We're just about out of time, and we don't know if New York Times readers care enough about all of this to change their lives.
I will say it's because I think there's a weird thing in our discussion where in the 1950s there were many sort of public theologians, Reinhold Niebuhr, Abraham Joshua Heschel, who talked about these issues in public spheres. And now we talk, what I do for most of my life, which is we talk about politics a lot, but don't talk about these issues. So whether my book is good or not, or whether that article was good or not, I do think there's some pent-up demand for people to at least think about these issues, and there's not much supply right now.
The book is called The Road to Character. David, thanks for giving us this time.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Brian.
Now, we'll continue after the news with reaction from some of our listeners to what David Brooks was just saying about the moral character of the millennial generation. And we'll talk to some of the unsung heroes of the hospital, still to come, nurses, and we'll hear how introverts struggle with dating and give you some advice. All coming up as we continue here on The Brian Lehrer Show on this Memorial Day. First, the latest news, live right now from the WNYC newsroom. It's The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Before the news, if you were with us, you heard New York Times columnist David Brooks talking about his moral bucket list. Now we're going to replay a call-in we had the next day, specifically for millennial listeners who responded to a question inspired by that conversation with David. The question was, did your parents raise you only to succeed or also to find meaning in life? He says parents are raising kids today with goals of academic and career success, but not with a vocabulary to talk about and develop character or to find deeper meaning in life. So we opened the phones the next day for millennials. First up was Steve in Hoboken. Steve, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Huge fan. I don't know. I'm what they consider in the Asian American community as a 1.5. I came here as a first-generation immigrant, so, you know, I was raised with that incredible work ethic with my parents, but they made a concerted effort to raise me in the suburbs of New Jersey. So in many ways, I was also raised amongst a lot of white people.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, like, if given a choice between my parents' struggle to get out of poverty and the vanity of, I guess, millennials, I would rather choose the millennial vanity problem than having to choose poverty. And I kind of have one foot in, like, both worlds, and I can very clearly see how both worlds kind of struggle with both problems.
Well, are they heading for the same thing? Because maybe a lot of the middle-class white people in the suburbs of New Jersey are looking at families like you, the Asian immigrants, maybe coming out of poverty, but with, you know, the so-called tiger mom values, very oriented toward career success, and saying,
you know,
we want to be like you, Steve.
Well, Brian, back to that point, my parents instilled an incredible work ethic in me, and they have an incredible work ethic, but it was not that tiger mom nonsense that Amy Chu was trying to exploit. They're very far from that, and, I wouldn't put that in the same vein.
Uh-huh. Do you think your generation is heading for a massive midlife crisis in 10 years because there's not enough meaning infused with a success?
I can see. I think a very famous comedian, and I'm not sure who said it. I remember the female comedian. She said, my grandparent generation, they worked their hands to the bone. And then my parents' generation, they went to college and innovated. And my generation snowboards and takes improv comedy classes. So with that being said, I don't know if, you know, this, I don't know if when Asians become this 2.0 generation, when they become 3.0, I'm not sure, because we have another foot. We have many cousins. We have a lot of families, you know, on the other side of the world, and they're doing tremendously well, too. So I don't know if we're if it's ever going to come to that. I'm not a futurist. I can't really predict what's going to happen, but, it might.
Steve, thank you very much. I really appreciate you starting us off. This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. And Shayna in Bridgeport, you're on WNYC. Hello, Shayna.
Hey.
So.
Yeah, so I work in a charter school in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We are a high-intensity tutoring model school.
A high-intensity what model?
Sorry, high-intensity tutoring model.
Tutoring model, uh-huh.
And we staff our school with recent college graduates who come and volunteer a year of service and work in our school. So I myself and a lot of the other folks on my team are millennials. We are people who are incredibly passionate about, you know, making sure that all kids in Connecticut, where we have a really wide achievement gap, are able to receive a high-quality education. And I just fundamentally believe that my generation and that the research supports it are civically minded and passionate about doing good.
Uh-huh. And do you relate to the idea? So do you think it's, at least for you and your peers, you were not raised only to succeed but also to be good and to do things that have meaning in the community?
Yeah, I fundamentally, like, my parents were themselves not first-generation but second-generation immigrants. I grew up in a really wealthy community and decided that I wanted to make sure that other people were able to go to the kinds of schools that I was able to go to. A lot of my peers are doing really exciting and innovative things with either running themselves nonprofits. I obviously have a lot of friends who are teachers, but I also know people who work in social enterprise.
Do you think your generation is headed for a massive midlife crisis in 10 years because there aren't enough people like you?
No, I don't.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Ethan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Yeah, just start off definitely answering the same question you've asked the others. I definitely think that we're headed for a major midlife crisis.
Because?
I just feel like people are narcissistic. They're very short-sighted. A culture of instant gratification. I'm 22, and I've grown up with Facebook and MySpace and Tinder and, every possible app that you could have on your phone and then delete and then decide you want it back. I think that, we're not ready to be parents, but we're not ready to be adults yet either. We have had previous generations pave the way for us, and maybe it's demographics too. If you're from a middle-class family, or especially if you're white, or maybe if you're a male, a lot of different factors come into play. But there is a certain privilege and luxury that maybe the first caller didn't have, being a first-generation immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely feel like it doesn't prepare us to be adults. It prepares us to go to college and to have a career. But not many people are thinking to what end, to what goals am I doing this? And it's not that we're not moral people or that there aren't compassionate, inspiring, driven individuals in this generation. But in terms of long-term sight, I think that we've been engendered in a culture that is very short-term.
Did you relate to the part where David Brooks said that a lot of his college students, when he teaches, come in with a great desire to do good in the world, to be good people, but they were raised so much with the language of success as kind of the overarching factor of what they were aiming toward that they didn't have the words for it, they didn't have the vocabulary for it that somebody might come in with if they had been more steeped in, one of the traditional value systems. And he was saying, take your pick. It could be one of the religions. It could be Descartes. It could be science. And the value of truth coming through science or whatever. Did you relate to that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I studied undergrad in philosophy, so it definitely helped me. But in terms of my peers, I mean, there was a great desire to learn and to better yourself, because you wanted to find what you were good at or what you wanted to do. But as a recent college graduate, knowing many others, a lot of us are currently lost. And people say, oh, that's just, going through the motions and you'll figure it out, no rush. But it seems to be everyone everywhere. It's a real endemic in terms of how do I be an adult today.
Ethan, thank you so much for your call. And Soest in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Soest.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love the show.
What are you thinking?
I was going to say my dad actually emailed me that article. We're like on a family email chain. And, my sister emailed back saying, oh, I hope we're definitely that type of people. And I think we are. And I think partly we grew up Unitarian. And I think, my parents were raised Catholic, but they raised us Unitarian. And kind of the whole motto of that church was, be a good person. And, I think we were more critical of ourselves than they were of us.
And do you find say that again, that last part, you think that you're more critical of yourself than your parents were of you because of being raised with Unitarian values by them?
Maybe not necessarily because of Unitarian, but for instance, one time I messed up in high school and got suspended from high school, and my parents were like, oh, you are punishing yourself. You're the one who's, you know what's right and what's wrong. We don't even have to do anything, because I was so upset with myself, basically.
Mm. Yeah, it's a pretty enlightened stance on the part of your parents, it sounds like, too, to be able to take that. To even see that their child is being hard enough on herself that they don't have to exert any authority or mete out any punishment.
Yeah, I think so.
Soest, thanks a lot. Andrew in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I like this topic. I think it's really interesting. My mom was a first-generation American from Venezuela, and my dad's been in the country for a few generations, and I was definitely raised to be optimistic and to learn how to be successful within systems, whether it's standardized testing or schools or college applications, and then eventually getting a job. And now I'm 25, almost 26 years old, and I'm unemployed for the first time for a long stretch in my life. And it's been like 5 or 6 months. And it's really hard because it's the first time that I've actually had to identify with something other than my work. Like, who am I outside of my degree or outside of my profession? And then when I was growing up, I never really was taught or even asked about who I wanted to be. It was more about being successful. And now I'm kind of battling almost like symptoms of depression now, and where my identity is coming from. And it's been a really challenging experience. So,
wow. You are David Brooks' poster child. You're having this midlife crisis at like age 25, right?
Yeah. I hope I'm paying it forward. But yeah, I'm definitely having to think very, very differently about my life now. Because I'm in a very unique situation, where like I did have a job right out of college, and then things didn't really go according to plan. I had to take a step back for a few years,
mm-hmm.
and then suddenly I was off course, and the trajectory that I spent my entire life kind of leading up to was incompatible with the landscape of my current lifestyle.
What kind of, if I may ask, career trajectory did you think you were on? What kind of work?
Yeah, I mean, so I went to school for marketing, and I went to a prep school in high school in Worcester, Massachusetts, and then I went to Emerson College in Boston, and then I studied marketing the whole way through, and then I got a job in the field, and I was really excited about it, and then I had to take a step back from it for about a year to deal with some personal issues, and now it's really hard being in New York, the city that never sleeps and always works, where I'm on the other side of that. It's like the epitome of where millennials are supposed to go. And to be successful, like if you could live on your own in New York and be in work, then you are, by all definitions, I think, according to millennials, at least myself, successful.
Right, even if I have to live with five roommates in Greenpoint. So are you coming to any early answers for yourself about what your purpose is in life?
I'm honestly trying to be happy and to meet people and to make friends, and I'm taking it from there. I mean, I go to therapy now, which has been really great, and I support that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not having a really easy experience navigating who I am outside of work.
It's a process, for sure.
Yeah.
Andrew, thank you for being so candid. I really appreciate it, and good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Eve in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eve.
Hi, how's it going? Welcome to the show. So psyched to be on.
It's great to have you. What do you want to add?
Well, absolutely. I feel like I'm coming from like the top of the millennial generation, so I was definitely raised in the internet technology spectrum. I went to school for like web design, but I was raised by a single mother that worked in the service industry, and my father was in the picture, but he was divorced, and he made a lot of money and was very, very successful monetarily. But the juxtaposition that I grew up with was that even though he had a very successful career and, you know, was able to bring financial stability for us, even from an outside of the household perspective for me growing up, he had a very sedentary lifestyle because that is what so many people that are aspiring to have some sort of importance in their career do. They sit on their butts, they are in front of a computer, and they are drones to the screen. He didn't necessarily do that, but it was still sedentary enough that now in his golden years, when he's supposed to be enjoying the money that he made, he has neuropathy and medical issues. And whereas my mother, who raised me after they got divorced, had a service industry job, she was up and moving, active, vital, interacting with the community, an integral part of it. And now she's in like the healthiest spectrum of her life. So mm-hmm. there's a huge juxtaposition that's happened from generations of the generation where we feel like we need to sit and stare at a computer in order to make money and have a virtual impact on society. When if all the electricity went out in the world, what impact is that really going to make anymore? As far as it's not a human interaction, yeah. it's all fake.
So this
and
is
my mother is enjoying the prime of her life now. So it's like, who really benefited in the end?
Right. Well, that's an even longer sort of life cycle view and, you know, interesting sort of technology critique. I wonder if you are relating differently to this whole question than, say, our last caller, who's, you know, very earnestly trying to find himself in his mid-20s after having gone to prep school and then through, you know, through an elite college and into a career and was taught success, and now he's unemployed and trying to figure out who he is as a human being. Coming up with a single mom who worked in the service industry, do you think the whole sort of context for you and these questions might be a little bit different?
No, not at all, because actually I was where that gentleman was. I mean, I went to school for graphic and web design. I did do that job uh-huh. for 2 years after graduating, and I found that that sedentary lifestyle was completely miserable for me. I didn't have any human interaction. I gained 30 pounds, and I found that I was extremely unhappy. I mean, I can still do those jobs freelance now, but primarily I now work in the service industry myself, and I feel extremely more gratified to be able to make human personal interactions with people that impact their daily lives every day. So I was where that gentleman was. It's just that, you know, a lot of people that have my education wouldn't settle for the demeaning sort of position of retrogressing back to a service industry job, whereas right. me, right. I feel like my personal happiness trumps having to prove something to society right. as far as my status.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. So you went through it, and there's where you came out. Eve, thank you very much. Let's do one more. All reacting, if you're just joining us, to David Brooks on our program, wondering if today's millennial generation raised so much for success, though he is bullish on the generation. He thinks millennials are very values-driven and want to and are going to lead our country toward success. And or he mentioned there's less divorce among the new generation. There's less teen pregnancy. There's less abortion. There's less substance abuse. So he's pretty bullish on the state of millennials and America with millennials growing into leadership positions gradually than the caller who he was responded to, who asked him how he deals with despair about the future of our nation, but also said that there's so much raising of kids for just success without meaning in this driven time, that he wonders if millennials aren't headed for a big midlife crisis 10 years from now. And we'll get one more caller reacting to all of this. Timothy in Manville in New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Timothy.
Hi, Brian. First of all, I love this segment. Loved yesterday's. I bought David Brooks' book last night after hearing the segment.
I guess you did. Thanks.
I wanted to add to the previous caller, I believe it was Andrew. I thought he really hit the nail on the head in terms of how I do believe we're kind of headed for a midlife crisis, but for a different reason than necessarily vanity. I think that many of us were raised not to find no meaning, but to find meaning in our work. And I was raised by two very professionally minded parents and raised to believe I can do anything I want. You know, and many kids, I believe, like me, were raised to believe that you can be anything you want. You want to be president, you want to be a scientist, anything you want to do. The only issue, I believe, with that is that while I think it's great, I don't know of a better way, it does kind of lead you when you hit, you know, your late 20s, I'm 27, and especially, you know, maybe in your 30s, to kind of wondering, am I living up to my potential, or am I doing the one thing that is essentially meant to define me as a person? So, you know, am I in the job that I want to be defined as, where that when these days it seems as if that's the thing that values you, or your definition of a person is who you are.
It's a similar response, you're right, to Andrew and I think to Eve, the immediate previous caller, who seems to have gone through that and come out in a certain place that she was describing. So are you coming to an answer for yourself as to what your place in the world is, other than as defined through your job?
Well, I go back and forth a little bit. Hopefully, you know, find a little bit of meaning in the book. It should arrive in a couple of days. But yeah, I think I'm calming down a little bit. I started feeling really anxious about, you know, did I pick the right major? I majored in geography, which I enjoy, but, you know, should I have gone in engineering or something else? I think I'm learning to settle down a little bit and find that not only is there meaning beyond your position, beyond your career, but you don't have to be in one particular career to find the perfect sense of meaning. You can find meaning and, you know, value in your life in many different careers, just in what you bring to it.
Sounds like you're in a good broadening phase. Timothy, thank you for your call, and that's the last call in this segment. Thanks to all of you for calling in. I think pretty meaningful conversation. Thank you all for your calls. Coming up next, we'll hear some surprising stories of bullying in the nursing profession, but why many nurses love the job anyway. Stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Right now, nursing is one of the country's most trusted and benevolent professions. But it's also a profession which garners bullying, abuse, drug addiction, and discrimination. Our next guest, award-winning journalist and author Alexandra Robbins, is no stranger to immersing herself in a world she's unfamiliar with. She's the author previously of Pledged, The Secret Life of Sororities, and the author of Overachievers, The Secret Life of Driven Kids. Now she has entered the world of nursing in her new book, The Nurses, A Year of Secrets, Drama, and Miracles with the Heroes of the Hospitals. She follows four ER nurses at four hospitals for 1 year. Their experiences are supported by investigative essays, including interviews with hundreds of other nurses who share their stories about everything from joy on the job to bullying and hazing. Alexandra Robbins, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Should this book be called Nursing is a Great Noble Profession, Underpaid and Underappreciated, but there is some dark, creepy stuff that happens to and by nurses, and that's what I chose to write about?
I'm not sure if you should go into the book titling industry. No, this is a book that celebrates nurses. I didn't romanticize the profession because nurses didn't want me to. Nurses asked me to write this book in the first place. This was not originally my beat. They wanted their perspectives and their secrets represented in a book written as, I guess, the kind of story that you can curl up with on a couch. That's why I followed four nurses, so readers can get engrossed in the main characters' stories. And yeah, I talked about everything, warts and all, because the things that came up in the nurses' stories are things that we have to address.
For this book, you followed four registered nurses for 1 year. They were each in the midst of a certain sort of struggle. You have Molly, funny, well-loved, and confident enough to quit her longtime job after her hospital ramps up anti-nurse policies. Lara, a superstar nurse, battling her way back from a near-ruinous prescription drug addiction that led her to steal meds from her own ER. Juliet, despite a lack of encouragement from fellow nurses, who saves lives while advancing her career. And Sam, a new nurse struggling to find her way in a gossipy, mean girl climate. So let me go to Molly's story first and ask you what those anti-nurse policies were in her hospital.
So this is something that a lot of people don't know about. Many workplaces don't treat nurses right. Many hospitals have nurses working 12 to 14 hour straight shifts without even giving them breaks to eat, even to go to the bathroom in some cases, take a walk. They're often assaulted by patients, and workplaces don't always put measures in place to protect them. They're disrespected by some doctors and often overworked because hospitals refuse to hire enough of them to cover the patient load. In Molly's case, there were all sorts of anti-nurse policies, such as making nurses pay for their uniforms when no one else had to pay for their uniforms in the hospitals, techs, doctors, and so on. There's just this sense of disrespect for nurses when nurses are truly the unsung heroes of the hospital.
And something you write a lot about in this book is bullying between nurses. One of your characters likens the environment to high school, except for the dying people.
Yeah.
That's a quote. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I'll preface this by saying that nurses are an amazing sisterhood. Their bonds are impressive, and there are truly wonderful nurse mentors out there. With that said, all four of the nurses I followed encountered nurse bullying in one form or another during the year. So yes, that was certainly something I looked into. There's an expression, nurses eat their young, which refers to how some nurses treat others. Well, on one hand, bullying is bullying. But on the other hand, some nurses told me that they're verbally tough on less experienced nurses because they want to toughen them up. They say, well, if you can't handle stern colleagues, then how do you handle, for example, an aggressive alcoholic patient who's sexually harassing you? Because that happens. What people don't realize is that these behaviors decrease in hospitals that treat nurses right. When hospitals keep nurses short-staffed, don't involve them in decision-making processes, don't give them breaks to eat, and so on, nurses feel oppressed, and they have zero workplace outlets for their exhaustion and their stress. By contrast, studies have actually found that when nurses are empowered at work, the bullying occurs less frequently. So this isn't about the nurses themselves, it's more about how working conditions cause them to act toward each other.
I see that the Workplace Bullying Institute in Bellingham, Washington, says it receives more calls from nurses than from workers in any other field. Teachers are second, by the way. Why do you think that would be?
I think it's because they feel like they have no recourse. Often the bullies are supervisors. It's not like nurses can go complain to the doctors or the administrators without worrying about retaliation. So many nurses feel they have no place to turn.
85% of nurses have been verbally abused by a fellow nurse. That's a stat in your book, 85%.
Yeah, it's a very common issue, and I think part of it is the tension of the high-stakes atmosphere in the hospital, and the other part is that I think sometimes there's sort of a misinterpretation, and again, this comes from the more experienced nurses who I talk to who say, you know, sometimes younger nurses misinterpret our tone as bullying. They misinterpret that we're trying to teach them, you know, we have 8-9 patients, way more than the safe maximum, and we're rushed and we don't have time to stop and explain things gently.
Victims of nurse bullying rarely have legal recourse because woman-on-woman aggression isn't discriminatory. You say, or you quote somebody who says, unless there's sexual coercion, there's no legal protection. If you're the same gender, same race, bullying is primarily legal in America.
That's right. And that's not just among nurses. That's among any profession. When women bully other women, and I think a lot of women can relate to that, it's not against the law because it's not discriminatory and it's not harassment. So, you know, victims can feel totally helpless and often are just driven out of the job.
And then there are doctors and patients who can be insensitive or even violent, too. You write that doctors' behavior toward nurses like throwing scalpels at them, berating them, affects patients. That nationwide, 63% of cases resulting in patients' unanticipated death or permanent disability in a hospital can be traced back to communications failures, such as this type of common disruptive behavior. Really?
Yeah, that's correct. When you have doctors who are so intimidating to nurses that nurses are afraid to ask questions, for example, or doctors who won't listen to nurses who try desperately to get them to go look at a certain patient whose vitals are changing and the doctor doesn't come because the doctor doesn't want to listen to a nurse. Sure, that can cause many problems among patients. And it was shocking to me that the disrespect that happens from some doctors to nurses, there are wonderful doctors out there, of course, can lead to this. Yes, they throw scalpels sometimes. A New York City nurse told me every single nurse I know has been verbally berated by a doctor, every single one.
And that patient assaults on nurses are rampant, but hospitals discourage nurses from reporting them. According to the Emergency Nurses Association, 9 out of 10 nurses were assaulted at work in the last 3 years. Why would a hospital discourage a nurse from reporting violence against them by a patient?
Probably because they don't want the attack on their PR. That's my guess. Many workplaces make nurses feel like being attacked is just part of the job. For example, oh, that patient is sick or frustrated, can't help it. But nurses are being shoved, kicked, bitten, scratched. Molly, one of the nurses I followed, was attacked by a patient who had hepatitis C, and her hospital offered no protection and didn't want to support her when she decided to press charges. She later found out that when she did press charges, the security camera wasn't even working. So there are so many things that hospitals could do to help nurses that they're not. When workplaces do protect their staff, the violence plummets. There's a medical center in Oregon that installed a computerized database to ID patients with a history of violence so staff would know that they should take additional safety measures. That one program helped to decrease the number of all violent attacks by 91.6%. So hospitals can protect their nurses, and it's really time they do.
We're talking to Alexandra Robbins, author of The Nurses, A Year of Secrets, Drama, and Miracles with the Heroes of the Hospital. And as some calls are coming in, you're right, from the perspective of the women, I should say, in these four profiles of nurses, inhabiting their drama makes the book very readable. Why do you think people become nurses? What was the most common reason you heard?
It's almost like a calling. These people, I can't say enough how truly amazing and compassionate and empathetic and wonderful they are. I asked them, you know, you put up with a lot of stuff in your job. Why do you do it? And so many of them said, you know what? Nursing isn't just a job. It's who I am. And ultimately, this book is, I tried to write it to be a story that gets readers caught up in these wonderful people's romances, triumphs, heartbreak, miracles, as a way to understand this group of what are really unsung heroes.
Jerry in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, yes. Actually, everything, I was at first when I heard the program, I said, oh my God, what are they going to say about nurses? But actually, as I'm in the kitchen pacing, I'm like, wait a minute, she's right. I was bullied as a nurse. I've been a registered nurse for 12 years, cardiology, and I was bullied by my fellow nurses, bullied by doctors, belittled by patients, and even, you know, nursing assistants in the hospital. But at the same time, every time I walked out of the hospital, I felt stronger as a registered nurse because there's nothing like being a nurse. I'm sorry if you're going to hear my three-year-old calling me. But anyway, okay, go ahead. And I mean, I think it's an amazing job. It's sad that it is true. Nurses do eat their young. My thing is, I was bullied as a child, and when I became a registered nurse, I refused to be those nurses who would bully or other nurses. So I made myself a preceptor for new nurses so that at least the first person they would meet as a registered nurse would be me. I would be kind to them, show them the good, the bad, and the ugly about nursing, and I mean, and to be able to stand up to, you know, when you know you're right. I've been belittled in front of patients by doctors because I refuse to give a medication that would make them sicker, or I've corrected doctors when they've ordered blood, transfusions for patients that really did not need it because they failed to look at the labs and things. With respect, obviously, and I'm friends with a lot of doctors, and we're able to have these conversations. Let me be your eyes, but at the same time, please respect me. And if you demand that respect, and if you carry yourself respectfully as a registered nurse while improving your knowledge about diseases and so forth, it makes a big difference, you know. And I make a difference. When I walk in this hospital, my hospital, I stand there with the doctors, and we are a team. I'm not working as a secretary. I'm your eyes, and let me be your eyes, and trust me with my judgment.
Sounds
That's
like
all
you
we're
should,
asking for.
Sounds like you should be the subject of Alexandra's next book. Alexandra, anything you want to ask Jerry?
She is exactly right. She's, you know, doctors tend to get the glory. It is time for nurses like Jerry to get a turn in the limelight. She said, I make a difference, and that's another answer to one of your questions before when you asked why nurses do this. Nurses make a difference in people's lives every single day. Right, Jerry?
Absolutely. And I'm so thankful. I'm almost in tears because I love my job. I love what I do. And, you know, we're unsung heroes. I'm sorry, I'm crying.
That's okay.
We're unsung heroes, but I would do it. If I wake up tomorrow and I have to start my life again, I would be a registered nurse. I'm sorry.
Jerry, you are awesome.
Don't be sorry. You're awesome, Jerry. Thank you for what you do.
You are awesome.
Thank you for writing this, and thank you, Brian Lehrer, for this program. It's amazing.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you for calling in. Wow.
Do you hear that passion, Brian? That's
you
not
bet.
Just Jerry. That's so many nurses across this country feel that way about their career.
Daniel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Daniel.
Hi.
So you're a physician's assistant, I understand?
Yeah, exactly. I'm actually around the corner from my hospital running it right now, a couple minutes late, but I was compelled to call. I've been a PA in various ERs in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens for about 11 years, and I think that I agree with basically everything the caller said and the author. I work with amazing nurses, doctors. I wanted to just make a point and say, you know, everything, all the glory, I think it's kind of known now. We all know nurses are heroes. I think a lot of us are heroes, people that I work with in the ERs. I mean, we work harder than anybody I know all the time, you know. I myself, I would say one thing is that, you know, as quote-unquote, it's been called mid-level practitioners, nurse practitioners or physician assistants, I would say one thing, you know, doctor, there's a hierarchy in medicine. So nurses, you know, are one level, doctors are the top level. And I would say, though, that nursing has such a lineage of leadership and administration and backing, and they really have people at their back, you know, from nursing supervisors and leaders in hospitals. There are certain professions that, like, they can really, you know, stand up for themselves in certain ways, get complained about, and they have unions often or union-like policies. There are certain positions like mine where, I mean, if a patient complains about something who was irate, maybe unfairly, somebody could be fired, and there's nobody really at your back. And so, in a certain way, I think that, and maybe the author can speak to this, nurses actually have a lot of power in a certain sense, although they may be in the hierarchy overall. It's complicated. They may be lower on that level, but at the same time, there's such an administration backing them very often that it's actually really a benefit. And I mean, that's not to take anything away from hard work and heroism and dedication and everything that they put up with. Harassment, totally agree with that.
Daniel, let me get a response. Alexandra, is this ringing true to you?
I wouldn't say that doctors are top level. There is a hierarchy, and yes, that's how it's viewed. But I think the goal here should be that all of these professions should be viewed as complementary professions that should be treated as equal part of a decision-making team. Yes, nurses have backing. They have support. However, not all workplaces give them decision-making power. Not all workplaces empower them. And if I could quickly mention nurse-patient ratios, right now California is the only state in the country that has safe staffing nurse patient ratio laws. What that means is in every other state, nurses can be overloaded with too many patients. And despite the support and the backing that nurses have, and the unions have been fighting for this, lawmakers and workplaces haven't come through.
Rosie in Sunnyside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to first thank you very much for putting this out on the airwaves. I am a registered nurse for 10 years now. This is a second career for me. I worked in corporate America for over 20 years in managerial positions, and when I came into nursing, I was just appalled at the lack of professionalism and the bullying between nurses, especially young new nurses who came in. Now, I came in as an older person, obviously, as a second career, and the bullying that was that I had to receive, which I just couldn't believe it. I work in an operating room, and surgeons have thrown instruments at people in the operating room. And when you go to administration, it's absolutely true. They don't want to get in the way of the doctor. They don't want to deal with the doctors, because after all, the surgeon is bringing in the money to the hospital, so they can't, you know, reprimand them for doing anything. It's just astounding. And also, I'd like to add, like, so everyone can understand, when there's a major catastrophe and you see a press conference with all doctors sitting at a table saying, well, we've done this and we've done that for the patient and this one's doing that, they didn't do anything. They walked into the room for 5 minutes. It was the nurses that changed the bandages, checked the fluids, checked the vital signs. It's the nurses that keep the patients alive. The doctors aren't at the bedside. They're there for 5 minutes.
I know that some patients who've been friends of mine in the hospital have certainly said things like that, like you wait all day for the doctor to come in for 5 minutes, and it's the others. But then again, you don't want to minimize the doctor's role. The doctor has all that education and expertise and is coordinating the patient's care and did other things, right? Are you reflecting a kind of competition?
No, not at all. It's not every case. Yes, I don't want to take away from the doctors. There's plenty of good doctors out there. But 9 times out of 10, I know colleagues of mine who've gone ahead and done a certain thing for a patient, you know, because they couldn't get in touch with the doctor. And then after the fact, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, doc, we've done this and we've done that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not always the doctors who are telling you do this, do that, and do the other thing. As nurses, we're well educated and we understand what we do. If we had to wait for the doctors to tell us what to do for a patient, we'd have a lot more problems with
and
patients.
And what do you make of surgeons throwing instruments around in the operating room? Is it the arrogance of hierarchy and they feel licensed to express their anger that way if they get angry at somebody, or what is it?
That, and they're extremely impatient. The type of operating room I work in is not usually a life and death situation. It's more of elective surgeries that go on in a major hospital here in the city. But they see a body part. They're not looking at a whole patient. So if they need an instrument, you know, there's an old adage in the operating room. It's like, give them what they need, not what they want. You know, like a surgeon will ask for a particular instrument, and if you don't have it, okay, we'll give you something else to use. And then they just go crazy. And then by the time the instrument arrives, they're already past that point. They don't need it anymore. So sometimes they behave mm-hmm. very much like little children.
Rosie, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Well, Alexandra, we're going to run out of time in a few minutes, but you've certainly struck a nerve here.
Yeah, TV gets the picture wrong completely. Rosie's right. And nurses are educated, they're skilled, they're trained. Nurses coordinate the care. They do a lot more than people realize, and they deserve just so much more appreciation and recognition and thanks than they get.
In conclusion, you have at the end of the book, you give suggestions to hospitals, doctors, nurses, and patients on how to address the issues you came across. So, for example, for hospitals and managers, you write, involve nurses in decision-making, use first names, prioritize security, and provide debriefing and counseling resources. For the public, appoint one family spokesperson. Watch carefully when staff members enter your room. Do as much as you can for yourself and the patient. And for nurses, find your A-team, volunteer, consider becoming a mentor, as it sounds like our first caller, who's still our – she's our, like, hands-down caller of the week, Jerry, if you're still out there. and take you time for yourself. So let me touch on one or two of those. Use first names for hospitals and managers?
Yeah, we've been talking with the callers about the hierarchies in the hospital. Have you noticed that in many hospitals, everybody calls the doctors Dr. So-and-so, but the nurses and the other staff members are called by their first names? Why do we do that? All that does is emphasize a title.
So universal first names is your solution
to that. Yeah. It could work. People, the Institution for Safe Medicine Practices recommends it as something that could work.
And for the public, appoint one family spokesperson was one of those. Why that?
Yeah, you want to do that so nurses can spend their time caring directly for the patient rather than having to answer repeated questions from various visitors over and over again. Family members can just write down all their questions and one spokesperson can ask them and then later share the info with everybody else.
Alexandra Robbins, her new book is The Nurses, A Year of Secrets, Drama, and Miracles with the Heroes of the Hospital. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, romantic advice for introverts. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and dating and finding love are tough enough for most people, but for introverts, they can bring a special set of challenges. Our next guest is coming to the rescue with Introverts in Love, The Quiet Way to Find Happily Ever After. She's a writer, speaker, and the author of numerous other books and blogs at Psychology Today. The Introverts Corner, as they call it, at Psychology Today. Sophia Dembling. Sophia, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, happy to be here.
How do you define an introvert?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a little bit of a moving target because there's a lot of science that hasn't been pinned down. But what we like to talk about is sort of the Jung definition, which is extroverts tend to gain energy from interaction with other people. Introverts tend to be drained of energy from interaction and need quiet and solitude to recharge.
You emphasize that being an extrovert or introvert is just one part of who you are and might actually say very little about your personality as a whole. Where do you think it actually fits in?
Well, it doesn't have a lot to do with who we're attracted to necessarily. You know, we're all on a continuum. Some of us are very introverted. Some of us are less introverted. We fall somewhere on that continuum. But what it really doesn't have a lot to do with is who we're attracted to. What it can have a lot to do with is once you're in a relationship, some of the issues that come up, you may be distracted by other things when really the bottom line issue is introvert-extrovert discrepancies.
The bottom line issue, as you defined introvert then, would be whether interacting with your lover or later maybe your spouse drains you of energy rather than refreshes you with energy because that's just the way you relate to human beings?
Well, to a certain extent, but it's a lot of it is sort of learning to balance out your need for intimacy and your need for solitude to help other people understand that if you do need to get away and get off by yourself, it's about your need and not about a rejection of them. A lot of introverts find that while the meeting and the dating can be a little bit stressful, once you're with a partner you're comfortable with, then you can sort of have some solitude together. You can be alone together, and it's a lot less stressful, the more comfortable and familiar you are.
Is it a temptation for an introvert on a first date or even before a first date to present a more gregarious version of themselves? And would that be a disservice?
You know, it really is a temptation. And in fact, many of us are really capable of behaving as extroverts when we need to. That's one of the misconceptions about introversion. It's not the same thing as being shy. We can turn it on when we have to. And to some extent, it can be. If you're going out and trying to meet people and you're really putting on the extrovert, I call it my dog and pony show, then are you attracting the kind of person who is then in the long term going to be happy with the quieter self who you are? I heard from one woman who said that they met in college, she and her husband, and of course everybody has sort of a lively social life in college, and then they got married, and she said her husband was so surprised to realize that he had, you know, tied his lot to an introvert who wanted to stay home at all the time. Mm. And that's sort of, you know, not really truth in advertising there. I think you want to be sure that if you're, you know, that you end up with somebody who does appreciate your many wonderful introvert qualities.
Hopefully you'd figure it out somewhere before you get married.
You would hope.
But you took a poll on your blog asking introverts where they meet people, and 44% responded that, A, this is something they have trouble with, and so, B, what are some of the good settings for an introvert to meet someone? What did your poll reveal?
Well, we things like you know, clubs and that sort of thing. One of the things I tell introverts is we don't really love going out. We don't really love meeting people, and this is just one of those things you have to bite the bullet and do. And so I say just say yes to any invitation that doesn't sound like torture. But the secret to saying yes is to promise yourself that when it's time to leave, when you've had enough, you are allowed to leave. It's a lot easier to say yes in the first place if you know that you can leave when you want to. I also recommend, even though, again, we're not much joiners, but joining groups or classes or something where you meet on a regular basis, because we tend to be slow to warm up to people. It takes us a while to relax enough or to feel what we want to show ourselves. So if you're around these people again and again and again, you're more likely to warm up and make some real connections.
That makes sense, because if you're in a club or a bar, then you have to put on that dog and pony show to meet somebody or have enough of a conversation to then, you know, follow up and get their contact information and stuff. Whereas if you're in a group that's defined by a common interest, then maybe it'll evolve more naturally for you.
Exactly, and even if it doesn't, at least you're doing something that interests you.
Ha, as a side effect. Mm-hmm. Latifa in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hey, Latifa.
Hi. So I'm not necessarily an introvert, but I am going through like a more quiet time in my life, and I just have other interests and I'm not dating. What would your advice be for kind of getting your friends to back off and not constantly try to be hooking you up all the time and always trying to set you up? Like, and just constantly, it's just, I don't know, I'm a little frustrated with, I'm starting to look at my friends like, is the only thing that we have to talk about, like, guys and relationships? Like, do we have anything else in common? What are your advice for that?
So, Sophia, that could be your next book, Introverts Not in Love Who Are Okay with That.
Yes, introverts exactly. Who want to be left alone for a while. That's one of the really big challenges introverts have is getting people to understand. Again, it turns into them feeling like you're rejecting or there's something wrong or you're depressed, and really it's just about who we are. And it comes from a place of love from them, that they're looking
yeah,
at you and thinking, oh,
I
my goodness.
That.
Yeah, yeah. But it's sort of just a matter, I think, of reiterating and saying, you know, no, this is, I've got these interests right now. This is what excites me right now.
Yeah.
And just keep bringing that conversation back around. Now, the thing about, you know, having nothing but guys to talk about, I think we go all go through a stage with that, with our girlfriends especially. And
I
it gets kind of old.
But I'm in my 30s
I hear
now.
That for
I'm
sure.
In my 30s, and I still feel like we talk about guys like we're in high school. Like, it's kind of like, when's the point where we're supposed to just be like, okay, we've got guys here, and then we've got other interests over here. Like, when do we just, like, start living our real life? I don't know.
Well, that's what happens. Then everybody has kids, and then they all talk about kids all the time. So, you know.
Then comes, yeah, right, obsession with talking about the kids. Latifa, thank you, and good luck with it. Even the fact that you could raise it means, I think, that you're on the way to figuring it out with your friends. Matthew and Wayne, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how's it going? My thing doesn't really have to do with dating per se, but my good friend Chris and his girlfriend, they're very outgoing people, but they claim to be introverts. And now it's starting to make sense. You know, we go out at night a lot, and they seem to want to leave really early, and they enjoy just being by themselves together and reading. And it's kind of hard for all of us to deal with that because we always feel kind of neglected. I was just wondering how you think we should go about trying to get them to hang out with us more, or if we should just let them be, or what's your advice?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah, you got to let them live the lives they choose to live. Or it may be that they'll be more interested in getting together in small, quiet groups or quiet places. You know, we're not necessarily drawn to the loud, noisy, to clubs, to bars, but I love a dinner party. I mean, I like parties. Plenty of introverts hate parties, but to me, the ideal party is maybe 20 people, most of whom I know. I go to visit with people I know and like rather than meet new people. So it may be that you'll meet halfway and find things to do that they're going to find pleasant as opposed to some of the livelier bar type activities.
And he said he always thought introverts were just shy people. You make that precise distinction. You did it a little bit before here, right?
Yeah, introversion and shyness are two separate things. So you can be introverted and shy, and certainly many people are. You can be introverted and not shy, which is like me. I can do this kind of thing. You can be extroverted and not shy. The people who really have the hardest time are the people who are extroverted and shy because they want to interact, but they're a little bit frightened. But shyness is sort of a fear, and introversion is motivation. You're not as motivated to get out there and socialize.
Sophia Dembling, our guest, author of Introverts in Love, The Quiet Way to Find Happily Ever After, and Ben in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Oh, hey, how you doing? This is a perfect call for me. I'm 35 now, and in my early 30s, I was still a very introverted person, so much so that I didn't even really date for almost like a 2-year period. And I got to a point where I just thought I thought I should be a little bit more open. So I forced myself to take a class, just like your guest recommended. And for me, it was Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is kind of like wrestling. It's a martial art. And over years of doing that, I'm still doing that now. That slowly just continually opened me up. It's a very intense one-on-one setting where you're literally wrestling and sweating with somebody, and it completely changed my life slowly over the course of years. So much so where, to the point where I was open enough, I think I was able to meet the woman that's now my fiance, and I'm very social now. I don't have anxiety at parties. I mean, there's still a little bit there where I know it's like, oh, we have to go to a social thing. But I see it all as a challenge now, and I take it. And I think you have to make a choice and force yourself into those situations, and slowly you get to be a little bit more comfortable.
What an inspiring story. Thank you for sharing it with us. But, Sophia, how are you reacting to that at the level of introversion is either something you can change or something you want to change?
Well, I think that we can certainly, indulge it or not indulge it to a certain extent. Introversion is considered by personality psychologists a stable trait, in that if you're introverted as a 5-year-old, you're going to be introverted as an 80-year-old. But at different points in our lives, we may act on it more or less at other times. I think a few things, though. I think that once we recognize our introversion and start respecting it and honoring it and saying, okay, I'm going to go out now, but I'm going to go home when I'm ready, it sort of makes getting out there a lot easier in general, because you start realizing, okay, this is the kind of event I like, this is not the kind of event I like, and you start acting on it that way. And so a lot of times I think that we tend to get anxious about getting out and about because we believe we have to be extroverts. And so we get out there, and we sort of get out there, and we feel like failed extroverts as opposed to successful introverts. And once we start just saying, okay, this is who I am, I can go out to this party and sit quietly and not work the room, the anxiety about getting out there will fade away because you're not going out there trying to be somebody you're not.
Wait, I think Robert in Queens is having an epiphany at this very moment listening to you. Hi, Robert. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guest was describing an introvert, and I immediately related to it. And I'm a recovering alcoholic, and so I'm just now coming to terms with certain aspects of my personality. And one of them is this idea. I have my dearest friend. I usually spend an evening with her and 36 hours or so. And when I leave in the past, I almost exhale with this sort of, I'm by myself again. It's where I love her and I love her company. And it's always been puzzling, this reaction of mine. And just one other thing, my favorite quote is by Rilke. Solitude is my lot. I implore those who love me to love my solitude.
Mm.
That's a great one. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, I wanted to mention drinking is one of the ways a lot of introverts, particularly when they're younger in college age, will deal with their introversion at parties.
Hmm.
I call it the extroversion in a bottle. And I think
exactly.
It's something that we have to be aware of. I smoked a lot longer than I should have because at parties it was an excuse to step away,
How about other substances? Marijuana and introversion? Do you look at that?
I haven't looked at that. I can imagine it, but it would really probably make you even quieter. Marijuana is less likely to make you to put the lampshade on your head and party.
I think we learned from a guest from Colorado recently that it might depend on the strain.
That's probably
but
true.
Nevertheless, Robert, what were you going to say?
The thing that's been puzzling to me that she addressed was that I'm very amiable. I get along with people. I can engage in conversations at dinner parties and cocktail parties and whatnot. So dichotomy has always confused me. And it's really been great listening to her because I'm going to get the book. Because it really answers a lot of questions I've had.
Is the person you're in a relationship with comfortable enough with your needing that alone time and having that, if I heard you right, having that feeling of kind of letting your shoulders down even when you're not with her, even though you want to be with her?
Well, it's just a friendship.
Oh.
But that's something I've learned. I've had to make my those closest to me understand, and therefore
yes.
the Rilke quote was that don't take it personally. I just need my own time.
Yeah.
If I don't call you for 3 days, it's just a personality trait.
Robert, thank you so much. And you might want to listen to our next caller, Jessica in Brooklyn, who I think is going to say something along the same lines. Yes, Jessica?
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I guess one of the things I wanted to say was I'm in a relationship right now, and I am an introvert, I guess. I also wanted to know if there's any clarification between having a lot of social anxiety and being an introvert, if the two are just go hand in hand, or there's a definition that sort of separates them. But, yeah, I just have a hard time in relationships asking for space. I feel like I'm hurting their feelings. There'll be periods where I, you know, want to hang out with them for several days, but then I need, like, a four-day break or something. So those are the kind of things I'm curious about.
There are more people like you out there than you may think. Right, right, Sophia?
Oh, you'd be amazed. I mean, the common wisdom is that, you know, America's something like 70% extroverted or something. But then the numbers have been crunched and recrunched, and it looks like we're kind of 50-50.
And so she's asking for advice, how to talk to her partner about this.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, when you think about it, why is the need for solitude less important or less valuable or less respected than the need for togetherness? You know, I mean, it is a matter of reiterating, this is about me, it's not about you. You might find that if you can take small micro breaks during the time you're spending together, you know, take a walk by yourself, it can sort of, it extends the amount of time that you can spend together without needing to get away. And as for social anxiety is something else. You know, things like shyness and social anxiety, if you are motivated to change them, those are things you can work on. Introversion is not so much something you can change, and really not something you necessarily need to change. It's not a problem. Social anxiety can be a problem if it's interfering with the pleasure you're getting in your life.
Jessica, thank you. Last question, 30 seconds. Should introverts go out with other introverts, or should they go out with extroverts, or is there no right answer?
There is no right answer. You might want to think about whether you're looking for somebody who's going to pull you out and get you out into the social stream, or somebody who's going to stay home with you. Different introverts like different things.
Sophia Dembling has written Introverts in Love, The Quiet Way to Find Happily Ever After, and she blogs at The Introverts Corner for Psychology Today. Thank you very much for joining us. I think you helped a lot of people with this. Thanks.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Have a great Memorial Day, everybody. Remember to take some time today to honor our war dead in some way. And thanks to all of you for listening. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll be back live tomorrow.